thing that got pointed out to me that I made a comment that somebody asked me, can this stuff turn into a character story? And I said, yeah, that's when you talk about children who get traumatized and never get treated. Because they're in the developmental stage of their life. And when you live with pain, you have to find some way to compensate for the pain. And what people usually do is develop some rigid pattern of compensation. And character disorders are rigid patterns of behavior that are non-productive. That's what they are. Non-productive in terms of the larger society. And so then what we see in untreated trauma is people developing rigid patterns of coping with their pain without regard for whether it's productive for the larger society. It matters, it's only useful and valuable to them to help them address this untreated trauma. And then we're going to hand it around.
Right. In your comments, would you also address the issue of repeated exposure to trauma and multiple kinds of traumas? Because one of the things that we have here in New Orleans, particularly with children, is children who are exposed to violence,
child abuse,
all sorts of things, but a lot of street violence before the storm.
Let me say a little bit about that. There are two different kinds of ways people get traumatized. On one hand, you've got this sudden, unexpected, overwhelming event, like a hurricane, like a plane crash, like you're coming out of a restaurant, somebody walks up and sticks a gun in your face and says, give me your wallet. What do you do with that? You give them your wallet and you pray that they don't kill you. And then you think about it forever. And so that kind of trauma, this type 1 trauma, is often the response is pretty significant, and it only has to happen, and it probably will only happen to you a few times in your life. You know, if it's a storm, like a hurricane, and you live in a hurricane prone area, you may have to go through one a year in Florida, or one every other year, or one a year in the Gulf. And you kind of figure out how to manage that. There's another kind that some people call type 2 trauma that results from chronic exposure to painful situations, like emotional abuse, low-level physical abuse, sexual abuse, discrimination. It wears you down. It just kind of, it's like somebody coming up to you and punching you, but not hitting you hard enough to knock you down, not hitting you hard enough to knock you out. And you kind of go, that didn't feel good, don't do that. But what, if they hit you enough times, suddenly it's sore. And then you begin to realize, oh, I can't use this arm the way I used to, because they keep hitting you on that shoulder. And that's what we call type 2 trauma. That is the consequence of exposure to some chronic, toxic element in your environment that's human-made. That this comes from a personal relationship you have with another person. And they don't mean you well. And you know they don't mean you well because they keep doing these nasty things to you. And so that we get some people whose source of trauma is a personal relationship with another person. And it's worse if it's a person you know, and it's worse if it's a person where your expectation is that this is a person who should be taken care of. And so when we look at the elements of trauma, how long it lasts, its duration, do you have the ability to free yourself from it, to get out of the situation? How painful is it? What kind of pain is it? Is it just pronounced sudden pain, or is it this chronic low-level pain? We get all of this kind of trauma on one hand, and balanced against it is what we call resilience. a person's ability to tolerate discomfort and to reorganize their lives to survive. And that has to do with the skills you have, how old you are, how intelligent you are, and how much support you have. How much support you have immediately around you when you're traumatized, and how accessible that support is. And so that as the trauma builds up, as people get traumatized in different ways, the balance, the weight on this side of the teeter-totter gets heavier and heavier. So you need more factors for resilience on this side to keep it balanced. Otherwise, it just goes tilt, and you get PTSD. Does that make sense?
I want to reframe what Bob just said in a way that I'd like for you to use it. You know, these are the PTSD behind me. I'm the guy who comes in the day after, and I know I've got a week. And you are probably going to be the person, the guy or the girl, that comes in the day after, and you've got a week. And then you're going to be there. You're going to have people like the people you saw yesterday, you know, that went through Katrina a year ago, and you've been seeing them, they've been coming back over time. But I want to take you back. I don't want to take you back. I want you to imagine the next one, the next trauma. You get the call, and you go. What is it that you are supposed to do? Folks, this trauma response stuff, most of the time in psychology, you make mistakes, you mess up, it's not a huge downside. You fix it next week, or the week after that. Or, you know, you didn't help the person, but you didn't do a lot of harm to them. That's not true in trauma. In trauma, you can really hurt people. You really can. So there's some things that you don't do, and there's some things you must do, so that you don't hurt people. First, you have to look to your own trauma history. Your own trauma history. I tell my cops, the person who brings a gun into the room is probably going to be you. So make sure that you have that gun fully under control. I say that to you. The person who brings trauma into a room, when you go to respond to a traumatic situation, is going to be you, your trauma. So make sure you've looked at that stuff, thought about it, laid it out, done whatever you have to do with it for it to make meaning, for it to make sense, and for you to be relatively comfortable with it. You never, never get fully comfortable with trauma. And I'm here to tell you that. 33 years ago, on July 30th, 1973, my fiancé was on an airplane that crashed in Logan Harbor. And I was one of the people responding to do body recovery. Because they called, airplane crash. I worked at Boston City Hospital. Go to the emergency room, and they say, after half an hour, nobody comes. We got a call from the airport, find all the body bags you can in the hospital, come on out to help us do body recovery. Spent the whole day walking around in 6 to 8 inches of water, picking up body parts. And I can tell you about some of the things that I've done. When my fiance was there, every time it's a hot summer day and I'm near the ocean and I have a hint of jet fuel in the air, it all comes right back. Right back. It's fully there. And I remember picking up that child's leg. Probably a 9-year-old child. Nothing above the knee, nothing below the ankle. But there were no bruises, no injuries, no cuts, no nothing. That's all there was up there. That's all there was. So, the trauma never leaves you completely. You integrate what you can, and you realize what you have that you haven't dealt with. And it's years and years and years and years and years and years and years. Let it go. Somebody said, what about more than one trauma? Somebody else. Yeah. Trauma is cumulative. You know, we clean out what we can, we make sense of what we can, we have left over what we must, and because we're human beings, we carry it all with us. carried all of them. But all those traumas in there, you know, the trauma you got when your mother's boyfriend decided to hang you out the third story window and threaten you with dropping you on the concrete, which I've seen happen. That never leaves that child. Never leaves that child. That child is 50 years old today. Remembers it just like it happened yesterday. So trauma doesn't go away. Now, you can hurt people in that situation if you ignore their trauma or if you bring your stuff and put it on them. And it's really easy to do that. Some of you have talked about listening to stories. Peanut butter is a great analogy. You cannot get it off you, not very easily. And you carry those stories around. But believe me, I have a person I talked about my trauma all the time. We've been talking for years. I hope you have somebody that you're going to talk to about your trauma that you're going to be talking to for years, because it doesn't go away. And the only way to really work in trauma is to know your stuff and be able to figure out how to keep it out of the way, because it can hurt that person. And you won't even know it, because they won't tell you. You know, if you do something that really hurts them, they're so grateful that somebody's listening to them that they swallow it. I can't tell you. Probably can come, but it's hard to come. People who came to Atlanta from Katrina on an airplane. I was at the Naval Air Station when they got there. They took them off the airplane. They sent them to neighborhood hospitals. People came with them. Those people were still wearing the same clothes they had on when Katrina struck. You know, they smelled bad. Plus, many of them haven't slept since then. Now, I could have imposed my stuff on them and said, you know, I'm a psychologist, I'm here to talk to you. Baloney. Those people need sleep. They absolutely, sleep and water. If you don't do anything for somebody in trauma, helping them to sleep and get hydration are the two most significant things. They will remember you forever. They say, this is the person who helped me to sleep. This is the person who got me a bottle of water. You know. So we got a barracks at the Naval Air Station. Marietta, for people to sleep who have come on the airplane from Rome. Very significant. People remember that. So, you have to know your stuff, and you have to know what you really, bottom line, have to do. In the immediate aftermath of trauma, there's some things you must do. Help people get sleep. Help people get hydration. Help people tell their story, but if you stop at that point, you can hurt them. You have to ask, and what was the trauma that happened to you before this? That's the only question. Ask them, what was there anything in your life that came close to this before? You know what? They'll tell you the story. They will tell you the story. And if you keep asking the same question, you'll eventually have all the stories. So make sure you have plenty of time. This is not a quick counseling session. When you're there, I promise you, it's several hours. And for most people, 2 to 3 hours, and then you have to stop, because if you let them go too much longer, it turns into spilling. And then they have boundary problems with that. So you help them close it off, make it make sense, get it to where they can then either go get something to eat or get some sleep or something to drink. Those are the critical issues. Ask the question, was there anything in your life that was similar to this that happened? When was the last? Let them tell you that story. And then you ask the same question, and they'll tell you that story. Then you ask the same question, they'll tell you the story about when they were teenagers. And you ask the same question, and they'll tell you the story about when they were 9 years old. And after you've heard all the stories, you stop. You say, yeah, you've talked a lot about your life. You've talked a lot about your life, about the painful parts of your life. And you feel it for them. It's a painful part of it. You say, you know what, tomorrow, or the next time, whatever it is you're going to see, it's probably tomorrow. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about how you can really make this make sense and help you move on. We don't want you to get stuck. And then let them go. But point them somewhere. You don't just let them go. You point them somewhere. You make sure they're going to somebody or to something. A lot of people call it psychological first aid. That's what we're doing. That's what we're doing. Right after trauma, we're doing psychological first aid. But you got to clean out the cut. You know, your kid comes, you've got a cut, and it has dirt in it. You don't just put a Band-Aid over the dirt. You clean it out. And then after you clean it out, if you're like me, you'll look at the Mercurochrome to put it in there to make sure that whatever germs are in there get killed. Okay, that's asking the question. Was there anything in your life similar to this before? Tell me. Ask the same question. They'll take you all the way back to being preteens. They really will. There's some that have even earlier stories, but you can't tell it all. The much earlier stories are usually very painful child abuse stories that led to some dissociative responses. If you haven't read the book, I Am Eve, come in if you have seen that. It's about a woman who, she became the Eve of the three faces of Eve, and she talked about what led to the dissociation that produced the multiple personality. A lot of people say there's no such thing as multiple personality. Well, whether you believe it or not, there is dissociation. And there's compartmentalization. If you want to call that dissociated and compartmentalized thing another personality, you can. But if you want to say it's not, then that's okay too. Okay? The point is it functions the same. And it protects those memories from today. But it leaks. All those compartments, all those things we do in our minds that compartmentalize things, especially sad and difficult and painful things, all those compartments leak. And if you don't tend to the leak, you can hurt it. You really can. Or you can help. Because the beauty of trauma, and there is a beauty to trauma, is that it opens it all up. You know, trauma has no age. It has no age. If you remember your traumatic event, it's just like it happened yesterday. That gives you an opportunity. It gives you an opportunity to get in there and do some of that psychological first aid with it. And then, you know, a year later, it's kind of sealed over until the anniversary reaction starts. And then that gives you an opportunity, again, not quite as good. It gives you an opportunity to get in there and do some more emotional first aid. Yes, sir.
Okay, you're saying to ask them about their trauma in the past.
Well, they got to tell you the story about the trauma in the present.
But I mean, doesn't it really depend on which theory of you're using? For example, psychoanalytical deals with the past, cognitive theory deals with the thought, Gestalt theory deals with the here and now. I mean, would it really depend on
I don't think so. I don't think it's a theoretical issue. I think it's a memory issue. And I think that if those trauma leaves its mark in memory, and whatever you could be the most cognitive behavioral person there is, but if you don't talk about the trauma that happened last week when you were held up with gunpoint and your spouse was killed, the fact that you're talking about Katrina today is not going to get it done. You have to talk about both. So, whatever your perspective, I understand your question, and I think it's a good thing to try to put things in theoretical points of view. But I don't think it's theoretical. I think how you approach PTSD, how you understand it, how you treat it, all of those have a significant theoretical input. But that emotional first aid, that psychological first aid, that right there, the day after it happened, and for the next week, is a theoretical. You're just trying to do what you can do to make this get a little bit better. And the way you do that, folks, in terms of my experience, you talk about this trauma, and you ask about the ones that happened before. And if they'll tell you those stories, you stop them before it gets to age 6.
Let me try to address that, because regardless of your theoretical orientation, what people come in and they present with is pain. And so that what we are asked to do is make it better. Help me figure out how to handle it in the here and now. Help me figure out how not to be so troubled by this every time it comes up. And what you may not be able to see this because it's
dark in here. I just realized it's probably too dark in here for people to see this board. What I did was I put the pain here, the anxiety, the depression, and the anger. And I put trauma 1 over here and trauma 2 over here. I could put trauma 3 over here and T4 over here. And what these are the sources of those memories. Because what is mediating this pain is a memory. And a memory here. Because remember, this event is over. It's done, it's finished. They survived it. What they've got is this memory of this event. And it's the memory that's generating these feelings. And so that from a behavioral perspective, in order to teach them to manage this, you've got to identify each trigger. Because remember what I said about memories? About all the different components? This trauma, the components might be the sounds and the smells. This trauma, the components might be the visual image. This trauma, the components might be the kinesthetic phenomena that you were trapped, that this person was trapped and felt like they were being smothered. The result is that once you tap into this anxiety, once a person gets really anxious and starts feeling helpless and vulnerable, once they start feeling helpless and vulnerable, remember I said that there's always a feeling associated with the trauma. So that this symptom, this anxiety, brings up this sense of helplessness and vulnerability, that guess what this does? It attaches to these other traumas. It draws up these other memories of the others, which then draw up more feelings. And so you get this wheel turning. And the only way to stop it is to identify all the different sources it comes from so that people are talking about what's contributing to this matrix, this trauma matrix. And that's why it doesn't matter what theoretical we've got this matrix that has gotten developed, that has gotten created out of multiple traumas, some of which are 50 years old, some of which are 5 years old. The thing about traumatic memories that really dogs us is that they don't fade the way normal memories do. If I asked you what you had for breakfast on September the 12th of 2005, could you tell me?
No.
Suppose I asked you what you had for breakfast on September the 11th, 2001.
Nothing.
Could you remember? You remember what you were doing when John F. Kennedy was killed? Somebody came in and told you that the president's been assassinated? I know what I was doing. I was in the library studying for a chemistry exam. I was a freshman in college. I remember exactly what I was doing.
You're as old as me, Bob.
No, I'm not.
That's what
it was. And so that the significance, the meaning of the event has a whole lot to do with how long that memory will last and where we place it. Traumatic memories last forever and can be pulled up by a lot of different triggers. And that's why you gotta ask people about what else felt like this, what else hurt this bad.
But then you can't leave them alone. Then you have to hand them off to a resource that they need. So when you go to do this work the day after, make sure you got your resources. We're going to talk about what you're going to take with you when you go the day after. We're going to talk about that because specific things need to happen. One of the things you need to have is your resource list so that when this person needs whatever they need, you have a way to connect them to it. And you can't just tell them about it. You got to take it to them.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Is this model telling stories?
Same thing. Well,
I love my school.
Angelo, you're up. We thought you'd never ask me to go. Get up and tell us about that.
Okay.
So it's a segue, but I think what I'd like to say first is that a lot of what we'll talk about with kids is not all that different from with adults. So I don't want us to think of it in these dichotomous children or adults, because there is an overlap, of course. This is an overview of what I'll be covering on kids, although not all of it today, because we'll be talking about some of these things tomorrow. So let me get to what's relevant right now. So the unique nature of Katrina, and again, this is my list, but I have a feeling that all of you can tell me things that I can add onto this list, which I'm very open to and welcoming of that kind of information, how you see it. But how I've been thinking about Katrina compared to other kinds of traumas and the uniqueness of it is, one, is that the trauma is prolonged. It happened a year ago, but maybe now you're going to start to see symptoms, reactions, responses that look like PTSD. Because people spent probably the first year either living somewhere else, fixing their homes if they could here, just in survival mode, denial and survival and shock mode. And so now they have the lofty luxury of sort of waking up to a lot of other painful feelings. And so for me, I think this very prolonged nature of this trauma. The other is basic needs for many of these kids are probably still not met. So aside from other traumas we talk about, like childhood sexual abuse, physical abuse, domestic violence, here the very basic safety network that children need to thrive is not there. So they're no longer living in the homes they always lived in. They're no longer going to the schools in the neighborhoods where they were. They may not be dressing the way they had been dressing. They may not be eating the way they were eating. So their basic needs are not, for many kids, being met. There are triggers everywhere. So if they're still here, it's very hard to get away from, you know, those triggers that will bring up a memory, because it's everywhere. Now the anniversary is coming up, and you know the media, for better or for worse, is going to be all over that, right? So the news channels want to get their ratings up. They're going to be all over these areas. Parents may no longer be seen as the protectors. I think one of you had mentioned that before, but children grow up with a very healthy fantasy that their parents are the ones that are there to protect them physically, emotionally, psychologically, and now these kids, they've either been separated from their parents and grandparents, or seen that their parents are not invincible. And that is psychologically very damaging to kids. Of course, kids don't realize all of this. They may not be able to put these things into words for you, but we need to know that and have that in the framework as we understand child work. The other is that many of the kids may have come from homes that already had other problems going on. And we know that at times of war and natural disasters, these other problems only get worse. So Bob had mentioned that. So probably the rates of domestic violence, alcohol, substance use, sexual abuse, all of that goes up. Suicidal ideation, suicidal attempts, we know there's been a threefold increase here. And so all of that has increased. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about what are some differences qualitatively in children and adults. For the first part of it is just the very basic and concrete developmental stage that the children are at. So if we're talking about kids, let's say 2 to roughly 15, 16, but right, actually, I take it back, right now I'm talking about the young kids. Their brains are not fully formed. So someone had a question about areas of the brain. One area of the brain that we know is related to how kids process trauma is the hippocampus, which is not fully formed in children. This is the area of the brain that helps you to encode information, make sense of information, which you need language to make sense of things usually. It helps you to inhibit certain emotions so that you don't freak out over anything. It helps you to understand things spatially and contextually so that you learn from verbal cues, from language, from sounds, from movements, and you make sense of all of this. And there's a reasoning capacity that is also involved, that the hippocampus is involved in. So sometimes I hear parents say to me, well, you know, he's 16 and he should know better and he's doing blah, 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 blah. And I often have to say, no, actually they don't know better. Actually, they don't have the reasoning capacity for a lot of the things that you're describing, like the high risk taking, like driving drunk. We as adults could say, the kid should know he should not drive drunk. In some ways, yeah, he should know, but when he's among a group of peers, he's very disinhibited, he's now had some alcohol in him, and he doesn't have a whole lot of life experience to make some judgments, and he doesn't have a whole lot of reasoning capacity that adult brains have. So children are different. And it's very important to provide this kind of information to parents. Even you don't have to be an expert on brain development, but you need to help parents make sense of why their kids are behaving the way that they are. And I find it very relieving for a lot of parents to understand that this is a developmental phenomenon. It's not that their kid is totally out of control or that they're a bad parent and can't figure out how to get their kid to behave. Kids haven't developed adaptive coping skills, obviously. They don't have the life experience that we have. And so they don't have that sense of mastery over situations of, oh, I know, when this happens, what usually makes me feel better is A, B, or C. They don't have this. They don't have the ability to regulate their emotions. Right? For some of us, if we've had a bad day, you might know, oh, you know, if I get home and I put on some music that cheers me up a little bit, I know that helps to calm me down. Instead of going home and turning on the news and hearing all the terrible, alarming news that makes everyone scared, I hardly watch the news. It's, to me, complete sensationalism most of the time. It's better to read the paper, listen to NPR, look on a website, or you know, listen to what bloggers have to say. The other thing about kids that's slightly different is that children are very place-oriented. Even, believe it or not, even more than we are. So where they go to school, they identify very much with, I go to PS 101, right? My family belongs to that church. I live in this neighborhood, and that means things. For better or for worse, it means things to kids. And so now with Katrina, all of that has been taken away, and their sense of identity is in crisis. Again, they may not have the words to explain this to you, but you would get to know this as you get to know the child clinically. Kids have simply a harder time adapting to physical change, much more than we do. You know, some little kids, if they like their favorite yellow shorts, it's more going to put on their blue shorts. That's like the trauma of the morning for them, right? So they're really not good at change. They're not good at transitions, which is why I often say to parents, and separate from Katrina, but other kinds of behavioral disorders, I always say you need to prepare them for the transitions. You need to say in the morning, okay, now we're going to get dressed. You know, after this, we're going to have breakfast. After that, we're going to blah, blah, blah. Especially, I work with a lot of kids who are somewhere on the autism spectrum, so they're Asperger-ish or high-functioning autistic kids. And we know that transitions are very, even more challenging for them. Young kids, as I've mentioned, don't have the vocabulary, the language capacity to put their feelings, to even know the difference between a feeling and a thought, but to put either of these into words for you. So it's very challenging for them to even ask for help. And so the parents are themselves dealing with Katrina, and now the kids are sort of flailing. They don't know quite what to say or do to help them process the trauma. Bob had talked about PTSD, and I'll talk just a little bit about it. There are these three major components of PTSD. Now, I should say, and I won't belabor it, but the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders, put out by the APA, originated by people that work with adults. So most of the categories, most of the behaviors, most of the symptoms that you see have been geared for adults, adult brains, adult functioning, adult pathology. So they took PTSD from adults and they applied it to kids. And I'll tell you that it's not always the same exact thing. And so it's important for those of you that use the DSM not to treat it like the be-all, end-all, but to think more qualitatively when it comes to kids. And there actually are good researchers that are looking to put together different classifications for children around depression and PTSD, which I think is about time. But for now, since our talk is geared towards both kids and adults, I'll still talk about these three major components. So what makes up PTSD? That people re-experience the symptoms, as Bob said, in dreams, in flashbacks, right? So they re-experience some of these symptoms and sensations and feelings that they had as the trauma was happening. A second component is that their whole system is hyper-aroused, over-aroused. They're over-alert, overly paranoid. They they get scared easily. They have what we call the exaggerated startle response. And I'll talk more about each of these. And the third area is almost different qualitatively from the second, which is avoidance and numbing of responsiveness. And I'll describe to you what I mean by that. First, I'm going to talk about re-experiencing symptoms or reactions. You know, the word symptoms is so pathologizing, right? And so we're talking about Katrina. Katrina's a crazy situation, and people are having normal reactions to a crazy situation. So I'll try to remind myself to say more reactions in kids. One is, under re-experiencing, is that they may have nightmares. Whether there's a theme exactly about Katrina or not, these kids now have nightmares where before they didn't. They now become easily upset or agitated when they're reminded of things that have to do with Katrina. They now start to have memories, thoughts related to Katrina when they don't want to have them, when they don't mean to have them. And so we know now kids are getting ready for school. That'll start in a couple of weeks. And I'm sure the teachers, on Monday, thank you, I'm sure the teachers are going to see some of this stuff. So the kids are going to probably look a little bit dazed, like they're daydreaming, like they're not wanting to pay attention, like they're going through this trauma reaction. They might have problems sleeping, either falling asleep or staying asleep is usually what happens around PTSD. They will be much more irritable, and things that didn't bother them so much before now do. And so it's helpful to prepare parents and teachers for this is normal. Even a year later, this is normal. And so your kid might seem off from how they were before. It doesn't mean you now need to go and punish them. You need to be a little bit empathic about what's going on with them. They have what I described before, an exaggerated startle response. So the phone might ring, the doorbell, somebody's cell phone, and they startle. They get scared easily. They have difficulty concentrating or paying attention. We're going to see this in the classroom with their schoolwork, recalling information that maybe last year they did know. The other cluster is avoidance and numbing of responsiveness. So now the kids might really want, either actually avoid or want to avoid people, places, anything that reminds them of Katrina. So the adults might be sitting in the living room or in the kitchen talking about it, and the kids don't want to hear it, and they go off somewhere else. They really can't tolerate to hear it because it triggers so much for them. A child might look what we call in the field as emotionally flat, which means simply devoid of emotion. They don't look happy, they don't look sad, they don't look mad, they kind of look zombie-ish and sort of flat. This we might see actually more in adults than in children, but it is also possible with kids. The kids might start to feel very distant from other people, from their peers, from their family, feel like they don't really trust anyone, which makes sense. If adults are feeling like their country, their government let them down, the kids are feeling like their country, their government, their parents, their school, the firefighters, everybody let them down. They were not protected. They might also start to feel very different from others, like that other people can't really understand them, and they become withdrawn. I would say this last item, sometimes for trauma workers, they have a hard time extricating themselves from trauma work because they feel like other people can't understand that they haven't done trauma work, right? And we'll get to that later, but if that happens, it's a red flag to pay attention to. In very young kids, now I'm talking ages 2 to 5 or 6-ish, those real little ones, there's changes in what we call attachment behaviors. Many of you have probably heard this term attachment, which is how children show that they need to be near their parent. And there's a lot we can say about attachment, but for now we'll just say that around times of trauma, young kids can look and become very clingy. So now the mom's gonna leave to take a shower, and the kid's like, no, you know, sticking next to mom. Where before, this 3-year-old was fine, just watching TV in the living room. The kids might get very easily upset over any kind of separation. The mother has to go to work. The mother has to go anywhere outside the home. And it's very helpful, again, and I'll keep repeating this, to educate parents to understand that this is not abnormal. And that there needs to be a time when you allow your kid to be clingy for now because they really do need that source of comfort and security. Little kids might become generally much more anxious. So now they've developed fears they didn't have before. So before, the boy could get up in the middle of the night, go to the bathroom with just a nightlight, and that was fine. Now it's not okay. Now he is very afraid of the dark, very afraid of sleeping alone. Maybe Monday rolls around and they don't want to go to school. They're really scared to separate and be in another place. The term regressive is a term that we use for behaviors that children are doing at an age when they had already mastered them. So for example, a four-year-old was fully toilet trained, but at age six, now starts to wet their bed again. It's regressive, it's immature, it's going back in time. It's regressing back to an earlier stage of development when they didn't have even the coping skills that they have now. Because as of their armament, you know, their ways of defending themselves have been really challenged and have been knocked down, and now they're sort of going backwards a little bit. They act immature. Other trauma reactions, which didn't fit completely in those three large categories, I mean, we can force them, but they don't fit completely. Again, why we need a DSM just for kids. They may have periods of confusion or blankness. We had just been talking about dissociation. They might look like they're daydreaming. They may have real gaps in their memory. Or they may have somatization, which we know is physical pain. Instead of being able to say, I feel sad or I feel grief, they'll express it physically. So they have tummy aches, they have headaches, they might feel nauseous. I mean, of course, you know, first you have to make sure it's not a real medical concern or cause, but it's a somatization from their emotional pain. They might have changes in their self-image and their identity. As I mentioned before, they're very tied to place and home and school and neighborhood. And now all of that is sort of being questioned because they may have relocated. Maybe now they're among kids who didn't go through Katrina. And so now they are the other among this other group of kids. Their identity could have been also in part affected by their religious and spiritual beliefs. So they are also questioning, as many adults are, if there is a God, why would God allow this to happen to them, to their family? And in their young minds, it's very hard to make sense of these larger existential questions. They may have what we call cognitive distortions, which means that the way that they think about the meaning of things has really changed, then for the negative, in a pessimistic, in a, might seem a cynical way, but they're quite angry. And so specifically to Katrina also, of course now, there's a fear of homelessness, if they're not already homeless, right? Helplessness, and it's not just helplessness in the day-to-day of I can't do this, it's more existential helplessness. A lack of a sense of agency about things. A real grief over the loss of their friends and their neighborhood. Even if these friends, I'm not saying these friends passed away, I'm saying they don't have communication with these friends now. And the stress of relocation. So yes, they're alive, yes, they're somewhere else. That is still stressful and needs to be dealt with. In older kids and in teenagers, there's some slight differences because they have other coping abilities. They might be just really, really pissed off. They're already pissed off because they're teenagers, right? They're supposed to be pissed off. Now they have even more of a reason to be really pissed off. So they're quite irritable. And it may be taken to a little bit of an extreme. They might also, and I'm not saying that kids who were never, never aggressive now start beating up on their friends. There may have been some aggression there, but now it's much more exacerbated. They may not ever have had self-destructive behavior, and now they do. I work with lots of girls who the moms will tell me, you know, they were fine age 2 to 12, and then she was sexually molested or raped, and now she cuts herself, she cuts on her arm, and the mom cannot understand why on earth this girl would do something so crazy. Well, this huge trauma of Katrina, I speculate that we're going to see some increase in real self-destructive behavior in the young people. Alcohol use, drug use, cutting. Their moods may be really erratic. They're already teenagers, their moods are already erratic. Again, another stressor is put on them. And so what we call affect dysregulation, meaning not being able to calm yourself down when you're upset, and when you're so sort of excited, again, not being able to calm yourself down, not being able to maintain yourself in a stable mood, but lots of ups and downs. And like the younger kids and the adults, negative changes in their religious or spiritual beliefs. And I would add to this, and we didn't mention this earlier, but I would say in addition to PTSD or trauma reactions are going to be depressive reactions, depressive signs. Actually, which I'm going to cover in one other slide. In the teenagers, I would imagine we're going to see more acting out. Things like truancy, promiscuity, running away, fire settings, personal violence. What we already see when kids have had trauma in their backgrounds, we're going to see in young people, I imagine. And unlike the young kids, teens may want to spend less time with their family and more time with their peer group, because that's where teenagers have a sense of belonging. They may also have shame over the material losses that their family suffered. So they were relocated, and before they had, you know, the sneakers that were in fashion, the right jeans, the right cell phone, all of this. Now they're living somewhere else, and they're not able to have these things. And, you know, teenagers can be pretty cruel. I wanted to make sure that we don't ignore the depression and the symptoms of depression that we may see in kids, which is similar to that in adults. So these are, I'm sure these are not new, this is not information, new information to any of you. So depressed mood, irritability, pessimism, cognitive distortions in a negative way. Anhedonia is just a fancy word for lack of interest in the things that they were interested in before. So now, you know, the young kid doesn't even want to play on their computer game if they have one. Or the young person no longer wants to hang out with the friends that they still have. So the real apathy about their peer-appropriate kinds of activities. Less energy, changes in their appetite, changes in their sleep, right? Because many kids don't want to go to sleep. They don't want to have nightmares. They don't want to have these dreams. Or maybe they want to sleep a whole lot, right? I see a lot of young girls that when I start to get to know them, and you know, maybe second or third session, and I want to get a sense of what their everyday life is like, and I say, okay, walk me through your day. So you get up at what time? Okay, 7:30. You go to school. You come home what time? 3:30. And then what do you do? Oh, I take a nap. For how long? Oh, 3 or 4 hours. Well, that's not very normal, is it? I mean, we know they need more sleep, but, and they'll say, oh, but I'm not depressed, right? So you start to get to know what their everyday life is like and the changes in their behaviors that were not there before. Young people may have suicidal ideation just like adults, and they may attempt it just like adults. Sometimes they're more successful than adults because they don't know what will really kill them, and so they do things that do really kill them. I already mentioned drug use and self-injurious behaviors, and I mentioned that in young kids. Now, since I didn't know, and actually I still don't know, the places where you all work and what kinds of assessment tools you have at your disposal, some of these may seem very lofty, but I thought I would at least provide you the information if you are in places where you can use these tools. So the first one is the child behavior checklist, which if you work with kids, you're very familiar with because it's sort of the gold standard of what we send to the teachers. It's way too many items, but it basically covers all kinds of problematic behaviors. So there's a parent version, and there's a teacher version, and then there's a version for the youth themselves, and it begins at age 7. And I believe there are two kinds, so there's one for young children and one for older kids. I'm just forgetting the cutoff in the ages. More specifically to Katrina, there's a trauma symptom checklist by John Breer. Now, John Breer specializes in sexual abuse, but his checklist includes many different reactions to many different kinds of trauma. It's sort of a quick and easy. It's not very long, it's easy to score. But there are two versions again with this one. So there's one called the Trauma Symptom Checklist for Young Children. And that one is, I want to say, up to age 12-ish. But don't quote me on that, I could be wrong. And then the other one is just called, as I listed here, Trauma Symptom Checklist. And it's for preteens and teenagers. To get a sense of depression, there's we call it the CDI, the Children's Depression Inventory, which is offered in English and Spanish and other languages. I use it often when I do what's called consultation liaison. So I go on the medical units, and there are kids that are going to have different medical procedures, and they have lots of anxiety before and after. Where I am in San Diego, it's mostly Spanish-speaking families, and so I often go on there and give these kids a very quick assessment. And so, briefly, it's each question is made up of three statements, and the child is asked to pick which one they identify with the most, and then you tally up the score, and it gives you a quick and dirty sense of clinically, do they seem to meet, you know, the threshold for clinical depression. There's something called the subjective units of distress, and some of you may be familiar with this. Essentially, we have to decide if we're going to talk about this later in the afternoon or tomorrow, but I'm going to walk you through how I think you should prepare to do trauma treatment with kids and what you should actually do in a meeting or session or visit with them, you know, whatever you call it. But the subjective units of distress is a framework for you to have in mind of trying to get a sense of how painful something is to a child. And it's on a scale. I've seen it in two ways. I've seen it on a scale of 1 to 10, and I've seen it on a scale of 1 to 100. Now, in my experience, 100 is and sounds like a lot bigger number than 10, especially to kids. So when I ask them something like, if I use a scale of 1 to 10 and I say, well, when you think about that time that he hit you, how upsetting is it to you? For kids, 1 to 10, it's not that meaningful. And so just on my own, I've incorporated 1 to 100, because then that gives me much more of a sense of, they say 100 versus 1, it's much more meaningful in their experience of the pain. So it's not a scale, it's not a measure, it's not a survey. It's simply a framework for you to use, and there is literature on this. And it's basically a framework for you to use for the kids of gauging on a scale of 1 to 10 how painful something was, or a thought was, or a feeling is. I tend to use with little ones an anger or fear thermometer, and I'm certainly no artist, but we draw it together, we just make a thermometer. And I put, again, I put 0 to 100 with, you know, scales of 25. And then I ask the kids to color in for me. So I'll say something like, I work with a lot of kids who've been through, witnessed domestic violence. And I'll say, well, you know, when they were hitting each other, how scared did it make you feel? And then I let them color up to what number they want to color. For kids with sexual abuse, the same thing. How scared did that make you feel? Okay, that's how it made you feel then. Okay, today, we're talking about a year later, how scared does it make you feel now? And it's important for you to gauge where kids are at before you start doing formal trauma work, because you need to know how fragile this kid is, you know, what their coping skills are, can they label their feelings, where are they on this trajectory of having been traumatized. So I agree with what you were both saying about when adults talk to you about Katrina, you want to know about other traumas. With kids, I would prepare them a lot more than that before I even get to talking about other traumas. So I want to know some concrete things. Like, I want them to be able to tell me, what does sad mean? What does scared mean? Can you draw it for me? What a sad face would look like. When have you been sad? The most sad ever. The most happiest ever. Now, who are the people that you talk to when you're scared or sad or mad? And you'll know by the kid what emotions you should be focusing on the most, because you'll know something about them before they come into the school or the office or wherever you see them. But you need to do a lot of preparatory work before you actually dive into the trauma work, because I do agree with Guy that you can do a lot of damage if you haven't prepared this kid for the kind of work you're going to do. So right now I'm working with a young girl who I'm positive has been sexually abused. I put, not that I have much money, but I would put all my money on, she's been sexually abused. And the first session, the mom says to me, I gotta know, you know, you gotta tell me. So, you know, in the 45 minutes you're gonna spend with her at the end, tell me she's been sexually abused. I can't ask a kid that very, she doesn't even know my name. Let her get to know me a little bit, trust me a little bit, see that I know something about kids, that I can act a little silly and playful with her too, that I'm not gonna tell her mother every single thing she tells me, because it's gonna freak the mother out, and that's not gonna be very helpful. So I need to prepare her. So we're now to week 4, and I just got, let me think about this. So I've had 4 sessions with her, and in the last session, I used this fear thermometer with her, and I said, give me a list of the things that have scared you, and so she named some things. And then I said, okay, I'm going to mention to you something that other kids have told me have scared them. I just want to know if you think these things would scare you. So I'm not asking, did these things happen to you? I'm saying, would these things scare you? So in there, I inserted very sort of benign things. And then I said, if someone touches you on your private parts, do you think that would scare you? And from her, you know, nonverbal reaction, from her facial expression, and from the way that she agreed with lots of sort of shame, that gave me sort of the green light that yeah, I know I'm right, and so we're on this path of she knows that I know that this happens to kids. So she doesn't have to worry that she's going to shock me when she tells me her story, right? Okay. Now, we had said we were going to, I don't know if we want to take a break. Do people feel you want to take like a 10-minute break? Was that a yes or no?
No.
No?